I will be interviewing today Neil Strauss. Neil is the author of The Game, which was a New York Times bestseller 10 years ago. We will also be talking to him about his new book, The Truth, an uncomfortable book about relationships. I would say that Neil is an expert in the twin addictions of sex and relationships. How are you doing today, Neil?
Fine. Looking forward to talking to you.
Why don't we start by giving our audience who may not have read The Game a kind of a mini book report and tell us about that first book.
Sure, yeah, I'll contextualize. And The Game wasn't quite the first book, but what happened was I was a writer at the New York Times, and I covered music and culture, so I did a lot of music, a lot of books with rock stars and pop stars. And somewhere along the way, a book editor called me up and said, I found a secret community of pickup artists online who are exchanging knowledge on the science, art and science of seduction in news groups, and I want you to write a how-to book about them. Just collect their information and put it together for me. And I said, I'm a serious cultural critic. I'm not going to write about these kind of adolescents running around seducing people. It's beneath me. And then, secretly, what I did was I joined that community under an alias and started learning everything I could learn because I was just, really lonely. I was professionally successful, but not socially successful. I was really couldn't connect with women, and women didn't seem to be attracted to me like they were to other people. So I kind of secretly joined this group and started learning everything, and that's where The Game sort of begins, and it's my sort of journey through this culture of pickup artists, what I felt was good at it and good about it at the time, what I saw as bad about it at the time, and how I really became lost in it and somehow became, which is surreal to me, voted as the number one pickup artist in that world. And it was very weird. And even at that point, people still didn't know I was Neil Strauss, the journalist. They thought I was this other pickup artist.
Well, Neil, what was special about your pickup line over everybody else's in the country?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, no one's even asked that. So let me think about it. I think one thing is I probably come off as, non-threatening. The best I can guess is that maybe all the interviews I've done with pop stars and rock stars and country stars and, I've been to Nashville for a while for the New York Times. And maybe all those interviews I've done allowed me to be very kind of empathic and, connect more and have a little more life experience. So that the best I can guess is, that's the best I can guess. I don't know. It's a great question. I got to think about that.
Okay. We'll get back with you on that at another time. Well, let's talk about The Truth. Now, that's your new book. It is subtitled An Uncomfortable Book About Relationships. Tell us about The Truth and why it's uncomfortable.
Sure. I'll answer that, then I'll get back to the narrative. But, yeah, I think the truth is, it's called The Truth because that's the thing that you need to have a good relationship. So many people, including myself, before this, compartmentalized things, didn't tell their partner things because they were just kind of scared that their partner wouldn't accept it or might have an emotional reaction that they can't control or not want to be with them. So we often hiding the truth, that especially the uncomfortable truth, and avoiding discomfort is often what makes relationships drift apart. And I think there's a lot of things in the book that are really uncomfortable because they really go to the roots of issues and problems, and hopefully we'll get to talk about them on this podcast and on the show, a little bit.
Okay. So I've got a number of questions that were proposed in your media kit, and let's go through some of them.
Go ahead. Or we can skip them and just talk about the journey, and you can go with your own stuff. I feel like it might be more interesting if you go off your natural curiosity.
Okay. Well, I like to talk about addiction, and I have a platform for talking about addiction to millions of people. I have my own program, Freedom from Addiction. That's the title of the book, which has a high success rate But I want to talk to you then about your addiction. Do you think that you were a sex addict or a relationship addict?
I'd love to ask you that. You know, I've done a lot of interviews and I've gotten asked that question, and I'm not quite sure, and I'm going to tell you why, and this would be a great place to have a fascinating discussion. Thank you for asking from your experience versus the suggested press questions. It's going to be a much better interview, I think. So here's what happened. What happened was, after I did all the stuff I was telling about the game and became the number one guy, that book kind of ended, and a friend of mine said, you got everything you wanted. You can meet any woman you want. You're not socially uncomfortable or lonely anymore. Why are you still unhappy? Right? And that kind of set it off. Okay, there's maybe something else. Something else is wrong. And the other books, by the way, that I wrote about, a lot of them involved sexuality. I would try to put myself in the way of sex as much as I could. But the real thing that kind of tore it for me was I met a woman who I really loved and cared about, and I cheated on her, and got caught, and that began this kind of spiral into really questioning the way I was running my life. How could I hurt somebody who I loved and cared about, supposedly? How can I, betray my own ethics and morals? How can I just maybe destroy my future because I wanted to have a future with her, and all for sex that wasn't even that good anyway? So I thought, if sex is so important to me, that'll violate all these things, maybe I am a sex addict. And so I checked myself into rehab, sort of to find out if I was, and also to learn about intimacy and connection and all that. And so what confuses me, it was a very interesting journey, because I checked in and they said, they were very extreme. They said anyone who masturbates is a sex addict. Anyone who watches pornography is a sex addict. There's some groups like Sexaholics Anonymous that say anybody who has premarital sex is a sex addict. So it seems like there's very, 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 very broad brush that probably makes a certain percentage of your listeners, sex addicts who may not be. So it seems like it was a very broad brush. Other people, of course, define it as you would know, as it being chronic and progressive and, having life, life-harming consequences.
Neil, let me break in right now tell you what my definition of addiction is and see how that relates to you.
Yeah.
I believe that if you have a behavior that you come to realize is hurting yourself or someone you love, and you can't stop that behavior for whatever reason, you're addicted to it.
Cool. Then by that definition, we've answered the question. By that definition, I certainly have an addiction. I think one of the reasons why I've sort of not, and I'd love to talk to you about, I'm sure you talk about your show all the time, but I want to hear a little bit about your program. But that, by that addiction, I think, by that definition, I think it's very, very, very fair. Because even when I kind of found out before I went into rehab, I, did it again even knowing I didn't want to. What healed me was not, well, when I went into rehab, what I found out was that I really shared a similar parenting structure to a lot of people who shared my problem, which was a distant, emotionally abandoning father. It's a family system that Patrick Carnes, who writes all those books on sex addiction, says as being distant and strict and do you remember the other criteria? It's distant, strict. I think that's it, the distant, strict household, as well as sort of a very, very enmeshing mother. And have you discussed the word enmeshing on the program? Or
No, I don't know what that means.
It's fascinating. So enmeshment is the opposite of abandonment. So abandonment is when a parent's, physically or emotionally not there. And enmeshment is the opposite. Enmeshment is when a parent is supposed to take care of your needs, obviously, growing up as a child. But enmeshment is when you're taking care of your parents' needs. So some examples include if you have a depressed parent, you're always trying to cheer them up. I remember I interviewed Jay Leno, and a lot of comedians, actually, I think, have said this, that they were were always trying to cheer mom or dad up, often with the opposite sex parents, and just couldn't. So they now try to cheer the world up. Or it could be that they were very, very full of anxiety, but anxiety wasn't about you. It was just about worrying about you so much that you're just trying to take care of their anxiety by kind of obeying all their rules and tiptoeing around them. Another thing could be when a parent's getting a divorce or they're just unhappily married, and this was during the latter case, where mom or dad are always trying to get you to take their side and complain to you about the other parents. So you're just taking care of their needs. You're sort of being parentalized. And a simple way to tell this, why it's a little more insidious, is if you're abandoned, it feels disempowering. It feels bad. And of course, these beliefs, you know, am I worthy of love? I'm not enough. All those beliefs it leads to early on. And when you're enmeshed, it feels empowering. Look, I'm taking care of mom. I'm taking care of dad. I'm daddy's little girl. I'm mommy's little boy. And that feels good, but it's later in life, it leads to big relationship problems. And if it's that same sex of person you're attracted to, as soon as they start to get needy or clingy, like, and even if they love you, it just feels overwhelming. It feels like it's sucking your soul. And it leads to what they call avoidance attachment.
So your developmental history within the family, you think, caused you to have a problem with intimacy and commitment?
Yeah, absolutely. And even if you look at the game, what was the game? But kind of finding out all these rules to have sort of some sort of power over the opposite sex, because I couldn't be, you know, vulnerable.
Right. Well, let me...
It's like, but 100%. As soon as I was in a relationship, I would really want to be in a relationship. I'd really be sort of obsessed and desire someone. We'd have a great, you know, few months. And as soon as love started and I start to imagine that they were getting needy, I would start to withdraw and we'd set this hole. It would all start to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what I think causes addiction and see how well it fits with you.
Great.
Okay?
Great.
I believe that addiction is caused by two things. The first one is a low self-esteem, and you can get that any number of ways, and family, environmental type, growing up, things where you don't feel good enough about yourself. But the other thing is a lack of spiritual consciousness. In other words, spiritually, there are some things that you don't know. Like, I wrote a book called The Four Questions once. Those questions are, who am I? Where did I come from? What am I doing here? Where am I going when I'm done? Most people who have the lack of spiritual consciousness have not even thought of those questions, much less tried to answer them. But these two things seem to be, to me, in every person who is addicted's makeup. Now, how does that fit with you?
I mean, I see that. I for sure see that as fitting. Absolutely. If you have a spiritual shift, there is no doubt to me that that will heal, will really shift everything, including the addictive cycle. Here's the way I see it, and I think it's interesting. It fits into what you're saying. And I agree with the low self-esteem, for sure. That was part of the way when we talk about strict parents, what are we talking about? Parents who are very critical and really led to the feeling that you were always doing something wrong. So for sure, and even the game came from places. The game, to me, was really a book about male insecurity more than it was sort of a playbook as people saw it. So here's a thought, and I think you might find this interesting, that in NLP, there are levels of your personality, and each one goes a level deeper. So on the outside is your environment. Right, a lot of people, I'm sure you know, when you talk to an addict, they say, I'm moving somewhere else to get away from everything. You just know they're going to fall into the same pattern somewhere else. Right, but so on the outside is the environment. It certainly doesn't hurt, but next is the behaviors. That's the next thing, and each one goes deeper and it's harder to change. Beneath behaviors is capabilities, and these are the levels of all the pieces. There's maybe six levels of who you are, each one going deeper. Then there's beliefs, then identity, and then the center is spirituality. And I think you have a shift anywhere on the inside of that, everything on the outside radiates out. For myself, you know, there was a spiritual shift. I think there really was. But bigger than that was the shift in beliefs. I think when you talk about low self-esteem, that's on the beliefs level, spiritual, that's on the spirituality level. So the belief that low self-esteem is whatever it may be, I'm not enough, I'm not worthy of love, no one will ever love me as I am. A lot of the game, right, is no one will love me as I am. I have to put on this fake personality. I think shifting even on the beliefs level could be enough for some people. I think anywhere from beliefs to identity to spirituality, anywhere in there, that shift can change things.
Right. You want to go back and talk about the truth and expand on what you said earlier?
Sure. Yeah, and all the stuff we're saying ties right into it. But I think it was fascinating. So when I was in rehab, to expand on what we were saying earlier, I was very cynical about the whole thing because I really just felt there were just all these rules and, you know, kind of this neo-Puritan thinking, and I was very sort of cynical about it until the moment when I put together my family history and it was really the, you know, always kind of being my mom's partner and her confidant as a kid, and her always complaining about my dad, me always being grounded. When I went to live with my first girlfriend, they kind of cut me off and wouldn't speak to me. I was never allowed the keys to the house so I could come in and come out. Well, all these things I put together. And I thought it was nothing bad. People in the group obviously had been through really real, what I thought of as big trauma. And I put talking about my time, it seemed like nothing. And then she looked at me and said, well, you know why you can't be in a relationship? I said, no, I don't. And she said, well, because your mom wants to be in a relationship with you. And she said those words, and to my logical brain, they seemed so surreal, but something inside me sort of just shifted. My whole past kind of came into focus. And then she said, there's a name for that. It's called emotional incest. And I sort of, it threw me off. I remember I kind of collapsed crying, but also I just was, what do you mean? What is that? And I later came out to find that this idea of emotional incest is when a parent makes a child not a sexual partner, but an emotional partner the way they would their husband or wife. And so it seems so ridiculous, but as I really thought over things in a conversation with my mother afterward, I really saw this pattern, and it was fascinating. And I really have seen it so much in other people that if you're still connected to your parents in this way, you're not always free to connect to other people. So that was the beginning of the change. But the interesting thing was knowing it was not enough. Knowing it, I'm sure you've seen it a million times, but knowing it was not enough to change, I still went and acted out for a period afterward.
Okay. So what is the uncomfortable truth of relationships? Is it just always telling the truth, or is it different?
I think it's a lot deeper than that. It's a lot deeper than that. I mean, and I also want to get to kind of my mission, because this really led me to what I feel is the message. But I think the uncomfortable truth is this. Most of the things we think about relationships get us to the wrong place and steer us wrong. Simple examples of, you know, one example is what we talked about earlier about always sharing your reality in a compassionate way, you know, not an offensive way. If you're in a relationship where someone is, you know, if you're in a healthy relationship, it's safe. But the second thing is, there's like so many people in relationships who are so quick to blame their partners. This is wrong with him or her. They're doing this. If only they would start doing this, they could just do this. And they do not look at themselves. You know, and there's been no case where I've really drilled down with that person where they're not equally to blame. And in most cases, unless you're living with somebody, you know, who's physically or emotionally abusive or, you know, really has a serious personality disorder, that if you make the change yourself, if you just make all the changes yourself, if you stop reacting, being provoked, judging, often it's a dynamic and both people are involved. And I'm just thinking of someone I was talking to recently, where he was saying his wife always feels judged, his wife feels like he feels she's a bad mom, so she's always yelling at him, getting upset at everything he says. And I said, well, are you judging her? Do you think she's a bad mom? He's like, I kind of do. I'm like, well, then she's right. So why don't you shift the way you think about her, and maybe you'll start having a different relationship. So the other uncomfortable thing is that the relationship has very little to do with the other person. person have to do with you and the way you relate to them. And that template is built, as you were saying earlier, by your first experiences of love in childhood.
What do you think?
And often what you're attracted to. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, oh, go ahead, ask a question. I was going to have, I'll have this later.
What do you think about when there's a controversy that comes up in a relationship and you see your partner has some defects or whatever? How about saying to yourself and trying to answer the question, how am I contributing to the problem here? As opposed to saying, well, my wife or my husband does this or does that or whatever. But initially coming back and say, what part do I have as far as having this problem in our relationship?
Yeah, and I would sort of put a little tweak on that, which is this. Your partner does have some defects because your partner is a human being, right? And there's this point in relationships. I know some people who can't have a relationship more than a year because they start to see the defects. And there's a great quote from Joseph Campbell, that professor of mythology, who says that, you know, some people will say after a while they'll see these defects and say, I was disillusioned. I'm disillusioned by this person. And he says, what better thing is it to be than disillusioned? To get rid of your illusion, see the person. So expecting this person to be perfect, like the mistakes we make are expecting this person to be perfect to not have defects. They're going to have defects, but are they defects you can accept and live with? And the other one is, they're not always going to be approve of everything you do. Some people want what they call unconditional positive approval from their partner. It's almost like they turn them into mom or dad. But they don't. Your partner's not going to like everything you do, and that's okay because they're a human being. As long as they accept you as a person, they don't have to accept all your behaviors and all your beliefs. So we have these unreasonable standards that we hold our partners to. And then we start to build up a story around it. Like you said, we find a defect. Like, oh my God, it's so bad. And then they start looking for it in everything, and it becomes a kind of confirmation bias. I can give you a quick example of how this played out in my relationship to make it literal if you want.
Okay.
Small thing, which was, I went to work out, and there was a film crew coming to film me for a documentary on these subjects at my home. And I was 15 minutes late, and my wife texted me. I'm now fortunately married and on the other side of this stuff. And she texted me and said, you know, there's a film crew waiting here for you. Can't believe you're not back. That's so rude. I said, oh, you know, I'll be back, and I'm leaving right now. And she just responded, so rude. So in my head, I thought, oh, my God, she's such a nag. Like, really? Like, can't I just live my own life? If I choose to be late, that's my life. That's my work. Why are you telling me what to do? Like, why are you always just nagging at me? Leave me alone. Don't call me rude. And then I thought for a second, then I stepped back, and I thought, wait, how often does she nag me versus how often does she say positive, kind, loving things, you know? And maybe it's just one time for every 30 or 40 loving, kind things. So I got out of my story instead of seeing every nag as a nag and ignoring the positive stuff. And then I thought, if you have a film appointment with a film crew at your house, and they're all waiting, they're all set up, and they're being paid, you decide to go work out and come 15, 20 minutes late, is that rude? And the answer is, it is rude. She is right. It's a fact that it's rude. So I responded, you're right, it is rude. I'll be right home. And then she said, you know what, sorry, I've had a hard day and there are a lot of people around, and sort of apologized for what she said. And instead of me building resentment or her building resentment, we got to have a relationship.
Right. You know,
go ahead.
We were talking about... after a period of time of being with somebody, you see things that you might not have seen early on. I wrote a book recently called Intimate Connections, How to Develop True Intimacy with Anyone Anywhere in the World in Less Than 4 Hours, so that you get all these things, 100 different items, out and expose them for discussion so that these things don't come up a year into the marriage or 5 years into the marriage. And so I just want to tell you about that. But
that's great. And how do you, I think that's so true. I see so many marriages that if you don't, one of the things that's really allowed ours to succeed is it's not, we kind of say it's not about being in, it's not about avoiding conflict and never having conflict. It's about how quickly you recover when you have conflict.
Right.
And like you said, if you just never discuss them, if you go to the rug, eventually that rug gets so full of, you know, dirt and debris that you can't walk out anymore, and that marriages become that. So I think that's great. Do you suggest we have format for doing it. I'm curious for you, what format do you suggest for those discussions or having those discussions in a safe way?
Well, you can have them over the telephone, but we've got to close down this interview. I've got about 45 seconds. Could you tell our audience what your purpose in life is now?
Sure. My purpose in life is, one, just to, you know, become the most, yeah, you know, become the most of kind of, to just to let go and accept. My mission in life really is, personally, is acceptance. And as far as the message to share is that, you know, healthy parenting is really the secret to peace and love and compassion in the world.
Well, there you have it. Neil Strauss, The Truth, an uncomfortable book about relationships. Go get a copy at your bookstore. Neil, thanks so much for being on the program today and talking about your life with us. You'll help a lot of people.
Great, I hope so. Thank you for a great